Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by Community Radio WERU, 89.9 FM Blue Hill, and at WERU.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's episode, we learn about three inventive and exciting theater initiatives: Lisa Leverton's Circus of Finance, Deirdre McArdle and Deiran Manning's Winter Harbor Music Festival, and Gilbert and Sullivan's Society of Maine, and Kimberly Lane's Millbridge Theater Youth Program Initiative. Welcome to Creative Maine, Lisa Leverton. You are the lead collaborator at something called Circus of Finance. And this is a fascinating theater-based teaching concept that I'm really excited to explore with you and hear all about. Circus of Finance is all at once. You've got theater, education, and an outlet for personal growth for the participants. So can you explain the concept behind this initiative and what it's all about?
Absolutely. First, I just want to say thank you, Adina. It's great to be here with you on Creative Maine.
Yes, thank you.
So, yeah, Circus of Finance is an intervention and an ongoing performance project. I like to say I am doing my best to chronicle the leaps of daring by citizens to, you know, understand tricky economics concepts. Mm-hmm. And in this exploration, theater has been used as a tool of visualization by participants, not just to learn, but really just to be able to describe to others, to illustrate for others. As I'm preparing this public performance now, it's through this, like, you know, I envision this familiar trope of circus being kind of comforting and also just providing comic entry to audiences. True. Who probably have really varied experiences with economics, you know, how it works. And so we're thinking about, you know, how it works, for whom, how it might work.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an armature to put your information on, the circus concept.
I go in knowing what we're going to be looking at. The past year, I had led two groups in exploring concepts, but they really selected things that they were interested in talking about, which I can say more about later.
You're a woman of many talents, and you live right here with us, among us. So tell us a little bit about your experience and how you came to be here in this place doing this very interesting thing.
Yeah, I'm Maine. I came to Maine not long after my years in the Playwrights Workshop at the University of Iowa. But the real story, obviously, is the way life happens when you're making those, you know, next plans. Mm-hmm. So in the Playwrights Workshop, I was really experimenting with low arc dramas. That means, I guess, low, you know, very moment-to-moment detail, like the biological drama of a plum tree's struggles. So, you know, not like Broadway type stuff, right?
Right.
So I was doing my best in this work to equalize the efforts of non-human species with humans and to achieve the comedy of failed human timing and also the timing and illustrate the way trees were setting buds too early. You know, we're vocalizing seasonal sounds and so there's all this detail, right? So you can kind of imagine that. Anyway, the seasonal sounds were really a way to illustrate where the cues were missed, okay, not just by the humans, plum tree, was budding too early. So anyway, you can imagine this kind of work takes time. This ensemble work really takes time to rehearse above and beyond learning lines. It's like a musical performance, not just a drama. So anyway, you can, I just say that this is just by way to say that there were a few plays in this vein, very subtle, and audiences were enthusiastic, but this work has been produced very sporadically. It's mostly self-produced for obvious reasons. It takes time. But anyway, life happened. As it happens, my writing took a different direction. My graduation coincided with the mortgage crisis. So after University of Iowa and before Maine, there I was in New York during Occupy Wall Street, where I joined an alternative banking group just to try to understand what was happening. You know, for me personally, universities were downsizing. There were fewer jobs. There was just a lot, you know, that to understand. And meanwhile, you know, obviously the CEOs are getting their bonuses during the bailout. But anyhow, after a couple of years in New York, I left and I came to College of the Atlantic in 2011 as a resident teaching artist. And it was quite the scene change. So in Maine, I became fascinated with the intimate scale of life in a small town on an island.
From it was Wall wonderful. Street to Water Street is quite a switch.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, there I collaborated with Drew Colbert, who's a wonderful artist, on a site-specific theater work exploring the local flora and fauna and lore. And from there, I really I began teaching at University of Maine and continued here and there teaching at College of the Atlantic, really leading students through storytelling and performance research projects and preparing them for ethnographic interviewing, you know, qualitative research type stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyway, as an educator yourself, you'll understand that most of my focus for 10 years was designing and facilitating student projects, and with less time for, you know, some time, but not as much time for personal work. Mm-hmm. Although I did produce a performance series at Waterfall Arts, inviting other artists to perform, and I performed in other projects. But after having left teaching in 2022, I was able to focus on projects that have really been burning a hole in my pocket, like this finance work. So having gone through that journey myself to try to understand the bailout during the Occupy Wall Street days in New York and learning about things like collateralized debt obligations, I went down quite the rabbit hole.
And I was going to say, that's not a phrase that's on the tip of everyone's tongue, you know?
No, but I think people by now have a sense that, you know, the mortgage crisis, the Circus of Finance project emerged. I was following up on an interest really in exploring our economic education as citizens. You know, what do we know? I think we're generally educated on limited topics. We might learn about supply and demand, but I would argue that it's taught through a particular lens, arguably biased lens with a trickle-down sort of free market bias. But that's a whole other topic.
It depends what level you're on. I mean, I have taught financial literacy to high school students. The reason why I find the Circus of Finance so compelling is because, having taught it to kids who are not necessarily enthused by the subject, to get them to understand even the basic things is difficult. And then when you start getting a little deeper, it's very difficult in a regular kind of traditional way. So talk a little bit about the teaching practices that you use through the practice of Circus of Finance.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing question, because really that is a starting point for that we are stakeholders in a world, and it's personal, right? I mean, I really hope to consider our ability to access and evaluate information that is currently hidden and illegible, and unless you know the playbook. So it really has to start with personal storytelling. You know, what are we seeing? What are we experiencing? And what does that mean? So, I mean, despite awareness of inequality, for example, I mean, my audience is obviously adults and not mm-hmm. kids. And so many of us are aware of inequality, and probably kids are too, you know. But educated Americans generally lack the skills to explain these concepts. And there's a reason for it, right?
They're not let taught alone, it as kids. They really aren't.
No. And not to mention, you know, here, you know, we can't explain economic concepts alone penetrate the trickier financial activities that are undertaken in private, you know, with hordes of financial engineers, quantitative analysts, attorneys, and lobbyists. So really the starting point, like I said, is personal storytelling. We're trying to catch up in such a short time, and our economy has really transformed from an equity-based equity change from cash equity and asset, right, with tangible assets to these derivative markets, where to the point where like GM, that used to make money, make their profit on selling cars, is now making more money on finance,
right?
Things like that, right? So it's one thing to teach kids like basic things like, oh, you know, transactional economics, right? And another to understand things that are really hidden. So I guess another core teaching practice, aside from storytelling is compassion, self-compassion, and vulnerability. It's pretty vulnerable not to know, especially as an adult.
Right. You're supposed to know everything.
Yeah, if that makes sense. And it's not a sexy topic, too.
Well, apparently you're making it a sexy topic. So how does the circus trope come in?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So, yeah, the circus trope came in because, you know, I'm trying to do this obviously pedagogical. How can we have fun learning? So I thought, you know, circus trope is really familiar and comforting, like I said. So, but I guess you're really asking, how does it actually work? So,
yeah. The nuts and bolts of teaching a financial circus.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the group, anyway, the two groups I led that were, you know, collective learning groups, we obviously started with reading and discussion, but then we were like, how can we, you know, explore metaphor to demonstrate these concepts? And so we began thinking, what kind of act is this? You know, what is this like? And so in an early improv, when we were struggling to understand private equity, we did an improv imagining, you know, what's going on in a business owner's mind when they're getting ready to sell in a leveraged buyout? You know, how much do they know? So we kind of envisioned it as a balancing act, a decision-making process that may have gone on, whether or not to sell the business, you know, and that leaning back and forth, like between concern over employees, are they going to be taken care of? They've really like dedicated themselves to, you know, making this business a success. And then on the other hand, leaning into that temptation over the retirement package offered as part of this particular private equity buyout. So there you have it, you know, Circus of Finance sort of came out. Exactly. And, you know, there's some comedy to be had there. You're an ordinary citizen. You're not a citizen. You're not a circus performer. You're illustrating a concept, interpreting it as a higher wire act, but you're using some tape on the floor. You're not, you know what I mean? So yes. We had some fun as we worked through, which is really a slog, right? Working through the minutia to understand the leverage buyout.
But you're finding humor in it at the same time. And
yeah, absolutely.
But what is the public performance part of this? How do you translate personal growth and having fun and learning the minutiae of some of these rather difficult topics to a public performance?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because that has been quite the challenge. You know, like I said, it was initially designed for participants, but then I got this grant from the Puffin Foundation to build a performance. It's still in the works. It's supposed to happen in the fall. And I'm working with a really inventive artist, one-person circus show in Portland who's incredibly skilled in circus arts and theater. And this is the understanding that it'll be a fun collision between movement and text. And my stuff is pretty cerebral, so it's kind of a challenge to
express
find ways
in movement and...
Yeah, to find ways to alternate between more text-heavy stuff. And I think there's fun to be had with a real circus artist coming in and maybe doing interacts or supporting what performers are doing. Like if they were just kind of trying to juggle, they don't really know how to juggle. Could be fun to see some juggling, you know?
So is the inference of the actual subject through action? So you set the stage and then you act it out kind of.
Yeah, so the stories of the people actually suggest a kind of act, and they find themselves in a circus. The circus sort of happens to us, right? Like life, right? They find themselves thrust, you know, these circus balls are thrust upon them, and they're juggling their mortgage, you know, and as life is, right? So I'm imagining that it'll be a supported performance.
Sure.
And casual
sure. So do you think given your experiences so far that the circus or theater model of teaching can be generalized to other topics too, from, you know, finance to maybe emotional topics or political topics? Do you think that can be translated into theater?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, theater is scalable, right? If you want to use the word, it's, you know, to learning. It's just lends itself to that, right? I mean, as a matter of fact, I mean, I was able to use this time to learn myself and sort of in the mutual aid spirit here, you know, I was able to actually work on a bill and find sponsors for a bill on private equity. So, I can personally recommend it. It's a fun way to explore concepts and take some of those high stakes anxieties about comprehension into a realm of lower stakes, relaxed play. I mean, I really had no idea where it would go, but we really did have some fun with it.
Okay, so your performance is coming up in the fall. So how can Creative Maine listeners participate? How can they find you? How can they find the Circus of Finance and participate, maybe donate or be an audience when the time comes?
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say before that, though, that this circus wouldn't have happened without some key collaborators. Okay. So we just want to give them a plug. This work was developed in collaboration with Countercurrent, a wonderful theater collective in Belfast. Oh. And definitely a group you need to know. They're doing a lot of site-specific work. Right now, their production of Carol Churchill's A Number is touring the Midcoast Maine, and they're also developing a new devised work. So they've been supportive all along the way. And of course, I'd be nothing without my intrepid participants. So anyway, as to how listeners can find me and support, you can visit the project website just to see, you know, get more information about what it is, which is inquire-within.com. And you can also write to me, email at inquirewithinproductions@gmail.com. And I'll be posting updates on my site. And you can also reach out on my Facebook page with the same name, Inquire Within. For those interested in supporting the work, it's great to be in touch with email, you know, get adding to the mailing list. I mean, there's no performance experience needed. Obviously, this is a public, you know, non-performer friendly environment. You're always welcome. And of course, donations are welcome in form of pledges for in-kind donations, which are important for matching grants. I mean, once we get closer to the performance, maybe you want to donate popcorn. After all, it's a circus, or your time, which is invaluable. Or maybe you know someone I should meet or want to participate. And I like working with the community in these more concrete ways, thinking of contributors as stakeholders and bringing awareness of economics in our community. Okay, great. Yeah, it's inquire-within. Mm-hmm. For the inquire within productions, all one word, at Gmail is the email address.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been very interesting. I feel that theater as a learning device is absolutely essential, and perhaps starting with the Bards was the first learning device. But I'm so glad that you're doing it here for us in Maine on such important topics. So thank you so much, Lisa Leverton, for joining us today on Creative Maine.
Oh, thank you, Adina. It's been so much fun talking with you.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. 10 Bucks Theater presents Pride and Prejudice, February 19th, 20th, 21st, and 22nd at the Cyrus Pavilion Theater on the University of Maine campus. For times and ticket information, please visit 10buckstheater.org. The Gilbert and Sullivan Society of Maine presents the classic Princess Ida on March 6th through the 15th at the Grand in Ellsworth. Visit GilbertSullivanMaine.org for times and ticket information. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the Community Calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and WERU.org. Next, we discuss Gilbert and Sullivan in Maine with Deirdre McArdle and Darren Manning.
Welcome, Deirdre McArdle and Darren Manning. You are respectively the founder and artistic director of the Winter Harbor Music Festival and Downey's Chamber Orchestra, the executive director of Winter Harbor Music Festival, and founder of the Community Opera Program, and the music stage director for the Gilbert and Sullivan Society. There's an awful lot of talent facing me right here. Can you untangle all those acronyms and institutions and initiatives for us?
I think I'll start out and then I'll let Darren take over.
Okay.
Because he actually has been transformative for an idea I had in 2009, which was to have a one-week chamber music festival. So that was the initial Winter Harbor Music Festival. And it has grown under Darren's leadership into a much larger year-round organization. And I'll let him speak about that a bit. I would like to put a little note here in about the Downey's Chamber Orchestra. That evolved out of the orchestra that was kind of developed to support the summer sing, which we had. And then later that turned into just a community sing in the wintertime, which has been successful. But we had an orchestra. And it didn't have a name. And then we realized we wanted to have a community group. A lot of people wanted to play year-round. So we formed the Downey's Chamber Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And we're always looking for musicians to join us in this. It's the newest, the youngest, and the only Downey's Chamber Orchestra in Maine.
Okay. That's very specific in terms of both geography and purpose. Yeah. So, Darren, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And you are doing what now? You've taken this idea that Deirdre had and expanded it. So talk a little bit about what you do.
Sure. So I took over as executive director of the Winter Harbor Music Festival. Now we're moving towards the name Winter Harbor Music. And basically in that time, we had a summer sing and a chamber music program. I have always had a strong interest in opera, so I kind of pivoted the summer sing towards opera. Mm-hmm. And that started out as one opera program. We actually, to reference Gilbert and Sullivan, 2017, we did Trial by Jury, but our first full-length opera was 2018, The Magic Flute. And since then, we've expanded to year-round concerts, and now we do two operas, and generally one winter event in December, generally an oratorio, or this past year we did Strauss's operetta Die Fledermaus. Now, for the Gilbert and Sullivan Society of Maine, I am the stage director and music director for the upcoming production of Princess Ida. Now, that's a separate thing, but we're thrilled to be collaborating with the Gilbert and Sullivan Society as Winter Harbor Music and having the Downey's Chamber Orchestra involved with that project as well as with some of our other projects.
Wow, that's a lot of projects. a lot of operas dancing in the air. We're chatting about opera today because this episode is more pointedly about theater, and this is musical theater. So personally, I had a wonderful New Year's Eve playing for Winter Harbor Music's production of Die Fledermaus. It was a wild and woolly time, and it was great. And it's a humorous opera, traditionally performed on New Year's Eve. And we're talking about Gilbert and Sullivan. So can you explain for us a couple of things? Who were Gilbert and Sullivan? What is an operetta as distinct from an oratorio? And there are funny oratorios as well, if you've ever had the coffee cantata on, yes. You know, and things like that. But can you tell our audience a little bit about what we're discussing here?
Sure. So I think I'll start with the trajectory and of opera and all of that, just to kind of fill us in about that. So opera as an art form is generally regarded as serious, though that is not actually true. There's a variety of different types of opera, like in the late 18th century, opera buffa, which was comic opera. Now, operetta is kind of an evolution after that, which kind of traces its roots to the German Singspiel, which translates to singing and spoken. So this was a piece of theater where the majority of the work was sung, but it would be punctuated by spoken dialogue. Mm-hmm. Now, this in the mid-19th century moved towards what we now call operetta. And this operetta is essentially, the plot is still developed and moved forward by music, but there it is punctuated by spoken dialogue, as opposed to with opera proper, there would be recitative, which is basically sung text with some chordal accompaniment underneath. Now, in the mid-19th century, operetta became very popular in Paris with composers like Offenbach, the Orpheus in the Underworld and the Can-Can that everyone knows was associated with that. Then operetta also became popular in Germany, and we just mentioned Strauss's operetta Die Fledermaus, which fills into that, and Gilbert and Sullivan fit along that trajectory with the popularity of operetta. They were a English composer and a librettist duo who created a variety of comic operettas, and these really fit well into the overall generic English humor canon, in my opinion. So if any of you out there have ever seen Monty Python, Blackadder, any of these English humor, very much you can see where that's coming from with the works of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Is it fair to say that today's musical comedy genre is an outgrowth of operetta?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So operetta existed before musical theater and all that, and then the operetta kind of lost popularity when musical theater started to take over in the early 20th century. And that was kind of the end of that as a genre, and was kind of essentially replaced by musical theater.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that Gilbert and Sullivan, as two men, apparently did not get along all that well. But creatively, they were an unbelievable team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So a lot of their work is tongue-in-cheek. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I would say pretty much exclusively. Even when they're trying to be serious, there's definitely an element of humor. And it's all very, very absurdist humor, very much dialogue that kind of has that feeling of prettiness to it, but also crassness to it, jokes that are implied, kind of like Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. In that regard, there's higher language, but you can tell that they're maybe talking about lower topics.
Lots of double entendre.
Exactly.
They're poking fun at the mores of the day. And
yes.
This is great. So Gilbert and Sullivan, or GNS to its friends, is almost a cult. You have people who are, they just sort of live it in their daily lives and quoted, and it's a very interesting genre, and if one hasn't experienced it, one must. So tell us a little bit about your musical journeys as musicians. I know, Deirdre, you're a flautist extraordinaire, among other things. So how did you get to Down East Maine as arts administrators and performers and teachers?
Well, I'll start off first and then hand it off to Dieran. So I started off as an actor and also as a mime. I worked for 2 years with two of the principals in the Israeli Mime Theater. So I was a professional mime artist. And then I pivoted. I had always wanted to play an instrument, and my family simply couldn't afford for me to take lessons. So I had sort of fallen into the theater because I was good at it, but I always yearned to be a musician. So when I was 19 and I was supporting myself, I was able to pay for flute lessons. And that's how I started. Very unusual. Everybody starts young. And so I'm sharing this so that any of you people out there who are concerned you didn't start when you were 3 or 4, there is hope. I went on to go to Conservatory Manhattan School of Music and then had a career as a solo flutist. Came to Maine with my husband, who is a physician, and he did his last year of rotations in Portland. We fell in love with Maine, and he took a job in Ellsworth at Maine Coast Hospital.
Okay.
Here we are.
And here you are, lo these many years later.
Yeah.
Okay. How about you, Dearon?
Sure. Well, I think that Deirdre kind of summed up a little bit of my path to Maine with that, with the moving to Maine for my father's job at that hospital. But I did kind of have a return path to Maine, which I think is kind of interesting as well. I went to LaGuardia High School in New York. So we kind of moved away for a little bit. That's for those of you who know the musical Fame. That's what that musical is based off of, LaGuardia High School. And after that, college at Indiana University. And then I lived in New York for a little while, working gigs and stuff like that. Then I decided to come back up here for the 2 weeks of the shutdown during 2020, which ended up being till now. So I essentially, my wife and I had always planned on, you know, having at least a part-time residence here. But when we came up here during the pandemic, we realized that we wanted to, you know, build our house here and stay here.
That's funny, because that's how my son wound up in Maine as well, from Chicago. It's like, came home for spring break and never went back.
Never went back.
Yeah. So I guess I kind of have re-fallen in love with Maine after having gone away and come back.
Are you essentially a singer, Dearon, or a conductor? What's your primary musical
outlet? Yeah, so I went to college as a pianist, and I work as a solo pianist, but I've always had a passion for theater. And I did take voice lessons, and I did perform in the operas in university, and also after that as well. And then conducting is one of those skills that you learn at any conservatory. So I learned that skill, and it's served me well in this area. Mm-hmm. And also stage directing. When I was at college, I was in, I think, about 16 productions. I was in like 2 to 3 every year. And
yeah,
even if you're not the one who is directing that, you start to learn, oh, this director is taking days and days on this one scene. How are we going to actually get it done? So you kind of start to learn what you like in terms of organization and directing, and you learn what you don't like in terms of that as well.
Right. There's an awful lot of, I would call it, arts administration that goes into directing a production. It's not just theatrical or musical. You're really driving the bus, and it takes a constellation of qualities to do that well. So, speaking of which, we have is the proper name the Gilbert and Sullivan Society of Maine?
Yes. It actually originally started out as the Hancock County Gilbert and Sullivan Society, mm-hmm. but they have since moved to Gilbert and Sullivan Society of Maine, as they are, as the title implies, the only Gilbert and Sullivan Society in the state of Maine.
Okay. And you have an upcoming production, which is opening in March. And the name of the production is Princess Ida. Can you tell us a little bit about Princess Ida and the upcoming production?
Sure. So this show is, as one might assume, about a princess, Princess Ida. This story revolves around an arranged marriage between Princess Ida and Hilarion. And this arranged marriage took place 20 years before the plot of the show. And it was arranged in order to prevent a military conflict between two rival kings. So when the action of the performance opens, we are under the expectation that Princess Ida will be arriving to marry Prince Hilarion, but her father, King Gama, arrives with news that she has forsworn men altogether and gone off to found a women's college. And this sets up Act Two, where in order to basically win her back, Prince Hilarion, with a couple of his friends, go to this women's college that they have founded and disguise themselves as women in order to get into the college in order to try to win her back and prevent this conflict. So you can see there's elements of absurd British humor, and also like going all the way back to Shakespearean style with Twelfth Night, you know, and disguising themselves as women and all of that. And also satire, elements of satire, because it's basically taking gender stereotypes of the time, which I'm working to update as well, mm-hmm. and parodying them.
Would you say that Gilbert and Sullivan were pro or con the women's college?
It's honestly a little bit hard to say, but I would say from my perspective, it doesn't really matter because I feel that I'm pro the women's college. So I'm trying, you know, every time you produce a show, it's going to be a little bit a product of its time, and it's going to be a little bit a product of what the director does with it. Mm-hmm. So you always want to balance those lines. But I think with this production, what we're trying to show is basically two groups. You have a group of men who are effectively sexist, and then you have the group of women who are also effectively sexist because and dislike the men. By the end, they realize that they're all just people. Which is, I think, also a very relevant message for today as well.
A good lesson for our time, for sure. Yeah. So how can our Creative Maine listeners find the Gilbert and Sullivan Society, the Winter Harbor Chamber?
Downey's Chamber Orchestra.
There you go.
Winter Harbor Music Festival.
And how can they participate themselves in some way, either as performers or as observers or participatory observers or however they can? How does one do this?
I think the easiest way would be to go to our website, which is winterharbormusicfestival.org. Mm-hmm. And their contact info is on the website. You can also email Dearon or myself, and Dearon can give his own email address. I'm dmcardle@winterharbormusicfestival.org. And I think that's kind of a good way to get started. The Downey's Chamber Orchestra is a part of Winter Harbor Music as it's year-round. And there's a little area on the website where people can look at, it says Downey's Chamber Orchestra. There's another spot that says Winter Harbor Music Center. There are different kinds of areas that people can investigate on the website. So okay. That would be my recommendation. How about you,
Dearon? I would say also that if anyone wants to be involved with the Gilbert and Sullivan Society of Maine, they can find GilbertSullivanMaine.org is the website, and you can be involved. I would say both organizations are always trying to find people to sing in the choruses and act on stage. Both organizations are always trying to find people to help out with tech and any aspects like that, also play in the orchestra. Also support programming, also just be in the audience. That's a very important thing too. So if you don't want to be involved by being on stage, just being in the audience is quite important, because what would we be doing if we didn't have an audience?
There you go. Absolutely not. Well, thank you both so much for coming on Creative Maine. It was a pleasure to perform with you, and it'll be a pleasure to work with you again. And I heartily encourage any of our listeners to investigate further and get involved. What are the dates of the Princess Ida?
Yes, Princess Ida will be the first two weekends of March. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 6th, 7th, and 8th, mm-hmm. and the 13th, 14th, and 15th. So I hope to see you there.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so very much. Stay warm until then. And I appreciate your coming on Creative Maine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Welcome to Creative Maine, Kimberly Lane. I'm so excited to have you on. You are the executive director of the Millbridge Theater. And today we're going to talk about the Millbridge Theater, its history, and some of your initiatives, especially your new children's theater program, which is tremendously exciting to have a children's theater program way down east. So tell us all about your theater and a little about its past.
The original Millbridge Theater was built, I believe, in 1937. It was primarily a movie theater. In the recent history, it was run by a guy named Dave Parsons, who is kind of a legend in the town now. And when he died in 2014, the building, just by virtue of its age and location, was in pretty bad shape. A nonprofit was formed called Gateway Millbridge, which purchased the original theater from his family. And the decision was made at some point to just completely raze the building and rebuild it. And they did quite a bit of fundraising. And in 2022, is when they started the construction, and it was completed about a year later, and the theater started operating in 23.
Now, let me understand, they did raise the original building, or they restored it?
No, they raised it. It was in pretty bad shape.
Okay.
A lot of mold, and, you know, it was kind of a joke among the locals, because they're like, oh yeah, remember this, and, you know, weak floors, you know, it was just...
Yeah, scary.
It was a pretty bad shape.
Uh-huh. So they rebuilt the theater.
Yes.
And did they rebuild it with anything, with movies in mind, or with live theater in mind?
Well, the fundraising, from my understanding, now I wasn't here, so this is sort of anecdotal of what I've heard, was primarily to create a movie theater that would have the capability of doing first run movies, as well as, you know, any kind of repertory, you know, DVD kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the new theater was kind of designed in this sort of fundamental footprint of the original theater. It's my understanding that things are switched side to side in the very front. So the box office is on the opposite side as the snack bar was originally. But other than that, of people who know, it's a lot like the original theater. And they were able to save some things from the original theater and utilize them in the new theater. So
good. So it has some of the feels, some of the nostalgia of the old building.
Some of the artifacts. So,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, the last time it was a movie theater, it ran reel-to-reel movies. So there was, you know, some amount of work that had to be done to fit it for kind of a, you know, a modern projector system. Mm-hmm. And of course, it has modern sound, 5.1 Dolby surround. So it's, you know, it's every bit of movie theater. Absolutely. And it has a big stage. So it allows for some amount of theater and live music. And there's, you know, it's set up to truly be a community arts center.
That's great. So tell us a bit about you, Kimberly. How did you get to Millbridge and the theater?
Well, it was kind of random.
As many things are, yes.
My background is finance and operations, and I've been in that field for 30 years. I was in that. I started out in securities and just went into investment banking, and my job was as an operational sort of due diligence person or a temporary officer to help the firm manage companies through mergers or acquisitions or whatever was going to happen to them. So I have a pretty broad spectrum of kinds, you know, types of businesses, but generally speaking, operations are operations and finance is finance. It was a little learning curve to learn nonprofit financial rules. And of course, you know, state of Maine rules. Mm-hmm. But at the end, it's a business. And so once you figure out how the business works, and I spent a lot of time calling other independent theaters and, you know, kind of interviewing their directors, and I'm like, okay, so what do you do all day? In the beginning, programming was not my job. And then eventually it became my job. So now it's operations as well as programming. And that's really the fun part and the challenging part at the same time. Like I said, accounting is accounting. It doesn't really change, but understanding programming and it's a modern era for movies. You know, people just don't go to the movies anymore. I mean, that's a national, probably international trend. Mm-hmm. So that's a challenge.
But you've filled the theater with a lot of other kinds of performances.
Absolutely. We've got music, we've had variety shows. You know, we had a haunted house this year for the first time in Halloween. That was super fun.
I'll bet.
And it's just trying to find what brings people in and to help support the theater.
Yes. Many studies over time have ascertained that participation in theatrical activities is great for children and for youth for many reasons, for teaching, for psychology reasons, for coping mechanisms for kids. There's so many wonderful reasons. So now I understand that you are starting a children's theater program, and I know that that is very near and dear to your heart. So tell us about what are in the plans for this program and why Millbridge as a community felt that this was a really important thing to put together.
Okay, so the conversation about children's theater, initially when I started to collaborate with Machias Act, which is the company that Dan Reynolds and Cindy Gelada run, and they do plays and musicals in Machias and Eastport. And he came to me and said, look, we'd like to, you know, run our shows in Millbridge too, because you have a theater and it's Washington County. And the more that we can pull the county together, I said, it would be amazing if we could get children's theater. It said, I know it's a lot of moving parts to figure out. They can't just hop in their car and come to theater class.
Right.
So, and then funding it. So about a year ago, we started talking about it. And about a year ago, roughly, I got a new grant writer and I sort of got her on board and, you know, talked it up and said, look, I really want to do this. You know, there's no fine art offered to kids in school anymore. There's nothing. I mean, you know, Narragansett has a music program because they have a music teacher, but it's my understanding that it's hard to find people to fill those positions and it's hard to fund it through the schools. So
yeah, theater, especially, I think.
Yeah. I grew up in Los Angeles where there was a robust drama department in my school because those who can't do teach. And there's a lot of people in that boat, but it just was such a whole other component to life in school. And then kind of part two of that discussion with Dan, I met a lady, gosh, it was probably last spring, who was kind of the director of a pretty large homeschool group. And we got on to the conversation of children's theater. And she pointed out that they had families that participated with their kids, but they were having to drive to Belfast or Ellsworth or Bangor. And it was not something that was available to everybody in their group because some people are one car families. Mm-hmm. Some people can't afford it. It's not free for any number of reasons. So I said, well, you know, keep in touch with me because this is something that we're working on. And so last Thursday was our first class.
Wow.
The first group that's going to go through this. It's a 10-week program. It has a strict curriculum. That was a requirement of one of the grants that we received, is that we had to submit a curriculum. So it's not just a kind of a free-for-all improv. It's designed every week. There's kind of a different focus. And so when I started talking to, you know, people sort of around me about it, about, you know, what we wanted to do, Dan Reynolds just serendipitously reached out to me. You know, we were talking about the new season for Machias Act because they are going to be putting on a new, their next performance is The Importance of Being Earnest in their adult theater program. Mm-hmm. And so I told him, I said, look, we've got some funding for this children's theater. It's amazing. Da, 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 da. And he was on board. I mean, I was kind of surprised because I thought he was probably too busy. But I think his wife, who's also extremely talented and has a lot of the same experience as him, is directing their latest production. So he was available and he volunteered. The first program, we determined the time frame that was available for everybody was kind of this 10 a.m. to noon. It's 2 hours once a week for the first probably 7 weeks, and with the production at the very end. So in the last few weeks, there's going to be more than one class a week because they'll be in rehearsals and things like that.
Sure. So the performance is when?
In April.
Mm-hmm.
And
what are you doing in April? Like which play, or I know you said you have a curriculum.
It's a secret.
It's a secret. Okay, never mind.
It's a secret. So as we get closer, I believe that one of the advantages of this particular first group is that a lot of them have had some theater and drama already. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a group that is interested in playwriting. And so I think that they are going to write their own first play.
Oh, which wow. Is
for a number of reasons, mostly the educational aspect of it.
When you're doing your curriculum, are you trying to hit main state standards for English or whatever, or is it just to satisfy the particular funder?
Okay, so Dan Reynolds, in his history, he taught theater at the elementary school level and I believe middle school. So he mm-hmm. already had that background of understanding what a school curriculum should look like. And the homeschool group had some targets that they wanted for the kids, because what we have is a lot of kids who don't necessarily spend their time together like public schools where they're together all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's bringing that group together as sort of one functional group that can work together. And we were more than impressed with how the first class went. It was incredibly successful. A lot of parents were here because, you know, it was the first class. And they walked out of it. Everybody was smiles. The kids were excited. It's absolutely beyond my expectations. So I'm really excited. And the goal ultimately is to provide it to more kids. We'd like to get an after-school program going. Mm-hmm. The problem with or the challenge with the school kids is transportation.
Sure.
So homeschool parents are used to they've right. got a system where if the parent can't transport, then the other parents kind of step up and they carpool, and it's very organized that way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure what that looks like once we go to an after school, but we're trying to do a summer program this summer. So then it's open to anybody.
Sure. Well, I think once kids in the community and parents in the community see what you've done with the homeschool group, everybody's going to want to jump on board, and some of these things may work themselves out.
Yeah. I mean, that's my goal for sure. I'd like to have any kid that wants to participate, be able to participate. Right now, the way the program is set up and the funding that we have, it's not free, but I think it's affordable. It's a 10-week program that's $200 for that whole time and that includes costumes and sets and all that. And we do have a lot of people that volunteer their time, carpenters and you know, sure. people that provide those things. And that's how Machias Act gets a lot of their props and costumes, is that people donate them, or they just sure. have friends of the theater, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, over time, you may also have, you know, a scholarship program, which would provide the necessary funds. So tell me, how can our Creative Maine listeners find you and Millbridge Theater and the the student program? Who can get involved, and how can someone get involved with the Millbridge Theater and Community Arts Center?
Okay, so we have a website, millbridgetheater.org, and there is going to be soon a page on children's theater. If you want to volunteer or you want to donate, there's indications on the website where to do that. And you can always call the theater or call me or come by.
How can someone call the theater? What's the phone number?
The phone number at the theater is 207-546-8029. Mm-hmm. And if they leave a message, just be patient. We'll get back to you. You can always email me through the website. You can email me directly, Kimberly@millbridgetheater.org. You know, Dan Reynolds is collaborating with this, so Machias Act is a good way to get a hold of people if you want kind of more information about what the program entails with respect to curriculum. So we're also excited about it. We'll talk to anybody.
Great. So when the secret of the play itself is determined, I think it's wonderful that they're writing it themselves and you have your dates for performance. Please.
We have a tentative date.
Oh, for the do tell.
Which is, I think it is likely the second weekend in April.
Okay. So well, that's terrific.
We are likely to do more than one show because we can.
Sure.
And once the theater's set up, the same way that we do the Machias Act, because we all do, Eastport shows it, Machias shows it, and then Millbridge shows, and it goes for a couple of days.
Well, do keep us in the loop, and
absolutely.
I will put this in my calendar section and let everybody who listens to Creative Maine know what you're all about. I think it's a wonderful initiative. Thank you so much. And have a wonderful program.
Thank you so much. And thanks for thinking of us for this particular show, because this is Creative Maine and the children, you know, they're the future. So we want
to
support them.
Okay. Take care now. Thank you, Kimberly Lane.
Thanks, Adina.
Thank you so much to my inspiring guests, Lisa Leverton, Deirdre McArdle, Deirdre Manning, and Kimberly Lane. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on Thursday, March 19th at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when we will learn about the power of craftivism. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.